All right, I think this thing's working. Let's go. Welcome to, or welcome back to, Colonial Outcast, your friendly neighborhood anti-imperialist outcast. This episode, we are going to kind of do like a free-form stream of consciousness. We're not really limiting ourselves. We're going to start with talking about Rafa, and then maybe get into U.S. ground combat in the unfortunately named Global War on Terror as a comparison to the Israeli Human Shields narrative on the eve of the Rafa assault. And you know, we could even end up talking about the Mahabharata, you know, the Indian spiritual epic. So who knows? All right, no limits. So we're just going to jump right in. I'm joined by co-host Mark Wayne and Travis, our regular military consultant dude who comes on once a week to talk about the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Thanks for being here, y'all.
Sarge.
Okay, yeah. Oh my God. This is where you say, thanks for having me on. All right. This is radio etiquette. All right. So,
who was our?
Oh God. You give me freaking black.
Hey, that's payback for you taking one of the best blows against the Army National Guard by calling us ROTC last time. Dude, I got to say, I've heard a lot of digs from the Army National Guard. That was the coldest, most brutal, savage insult I've ever heard. But I got to hand it to you. That I got to remember that one.
It was unintentional. I just thought you were in the ROTC. I'm sorry, man. I should be a better listener when you tell me your life story.
Oh, you don't. I don't think. Yeah. I mean, the real insult is to call him JROTC.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. ROTC is just commissioning source. That's not even really an element.
Yeah.
I mean, It was a savage dig, though. I'm got to say that was a good savage dig. I know you say it was not conscious. I think it was subconscious.
I've served on. I think you did too. Yeah, we both served on both sides, active and guard. And I just remember when I was in CAV, my first sergeant, whenever he thought something was particularly fucked up, he would yell, "That's National Guard as fuck." But
oh, Jesus Christ!
But I also served in I served in 4th Battalion HIMARS in the National Guard, and that was an artillery unit as good as any active unit I've ever worked for. So
yeah,
you know,
damn right.
It really depends on who you're talking about, you know.
So. And in fact, for that, you guys are gonna call me something cool like Nighthawk.
I'm not calling you that. And to circle back, I
totally will. I don't think it's good for you, but I'll do it.
Circle back. It was unintentional. I guess I just lucked out by having it be a massive insult, though. All right. Sorry. Okay, so
Greg, like most soft guys, has no idea how the fucking army works outside of soft. It's just no concept.
Yeah. Okay, so for the audience, outside of special operations, I don't really know the nitty-gritty of how the military functions, okay? I'm used to, like, lifting weights and like trying to look as cool as possible, because that's what we were all about. So
special guns and special helicopters and special pants, and you know, yeah,
it's all sexual harassment, suicide training anyway.
Pretty much, yeah, I would say that's accurate from what I've seen of it. But
all right, so here we go, Rafa. We've been talking about this for about a month now. The first operational breakdown we did on it was, I think, off the top of my head, February 14th. It's now March 19th, going into March 20th. They've been talking about this. They've been stalling. They've been flying bombing sorties over Rafah. There's been international debate sustained. The cracks in the relationship between Biden and Netanyahu have become very apparent over the past 4 weeks. With today, we're seeing it at its most strained. First of all, the White House accidentally started leaking. There's nothing accidental about them leaking Biden's internal conversations, saying that Netanyahu's, quote, a bad fucking guy. Did he use guy or dude? Not that it matters. I'm just curious.
I think he said guy.
Okay. It'd be cooler if he said dude, but nothing Biden does that Genocide Joe could do is cool at this point. So
he did say he needed to come to Jesus. So that, I mean, that was accidentally hilarious. So
yeah, I mean, maybe he is a closet evangelical and he does want a third of the Jewish people in Israel to convert before the end times. So anyways, he said don't go into Rafah. BB says, like, watch me. Biden says, don't you do it. And then the Israeli government yesterday in the evening, at least here in America, said they were sending a special delegation to Washington to discuss the ins and outs of the upcoming Rafah assault. So we're still waiting on the delegation, as far as I can tell. About 5 hours ago on Haaretz, they published this banger of an article. Let me share it on the screen. Yeah, again, I have the Haaretz subscription, so you guys don't have to. So the title is, "We have a dispute with the Americans. Netanyahu tells Knesset, quote, we must all unite against U.S. attempt to prevent Israeli invasion of Rafah," unquote. The subheader is, Netanyahu's office said that the prime minister told lawmakers that Israel has a dispute with the United States about the need to go into Rafah, but not about the necessity to eliminate Hamas. So essentially saying, yeah, we both agree that we need to eliminate Hamas. The United States is saying, don't go into Rafah. But Netanyahu's framing it like he's saying, no, if we want to eliminate Hamas, which we both agree on, we need to go into Rafah. Now, there's a lot of reasons that the United States does not want Israel to go into Rafah. First of all, on a very basic level, you can go back to all of our previous operational breakdowns where we continue to expand on this. It's completely operationally infeasible. It's going to be what we call in the military, the technical jargon term would be an absolute unmitigated clusterfuck. It would be a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions that we don't know how many people would die or be displaced, innocent civilians. And the only reason they would do it is so that Netanyahu can go in there, say, complete victory or keep it going to ensure his own existential political survival, declare that after a while Hamas has been defeated or degraded to such a point that they can now sue for terms and a ceasefire. But it's just going to be a symbolic victory because, as we know, that all the IDF propaganda is not for us. They're for the Israeli people and the IDF simps in the West. So, that's where the Rafah thing stands. I don't know if you guys have any commentary off the cuff on this whole situation.
Well, I mean, that's the headline, right? The official headline. Obviously, what all this is just the U.S. distancing itself from any result that happens out of the invasion of Rafah. So, obviously, the U.S. government knows that it's going to be a bloodbath, and they're just preemptively trying to distance themselves right from that by officially saying, oh, don't do it. And they might as well just be like, yeah, go ahead and do it, but just don't do it publicly. So that's how I read this whole situation. And again, as we all know, I'm the speculator amongst the three of us. That's my job, is to speculate. But my speculation is that this is just a way of the United States distancing from what's about to happen, which is probably going to be another about 100 flower massacres, possibly.
I mean, I'd say that could potentially be a conservative estimate. One more paragraph verbatim from this article. According to the statement by Netanyahu's office, the prime minister said at the opening of the Knesset session on Tuesday that, quote, you cannot say we'll destroy only 80% of Hamas because the remaining 20% will reorganize and retake the strip. The same logic, even if only 5%, lives, even if 0% lives, survives, which would never happen because, they're not going to be defeated in the field.
The math of what he's talking about doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Those percentages don't matter because they can't do that. They haven't been doing that. What's disgusting is what that actually equates to is we'll destroy only 80% of Hamas. What you've done is destroy 80% of the Gaza, of Gaza. They haven't destroyed 80% of Hamas. They haven't been that effective. So I call BS on that whole sentence. Not your point about it, but them even saying things like that because you're not that effective, and that's not how counterinsurgency works ever, right? It's not like, oh, I bombed 80% of the city, so 80% of the insurgents must be gone. Cool, yeah, that totally worked in Stalingrad too. Good math.
Yeah.
And the second piece, I read it a little bit differently. Again, this is also speculation, so I don't want to sit here and pretend that I know I'm right, but the way I read it is the Biden administration has made moves that, while a lot of them I agree are very performative, there are some of them that I think are very threatening to Netanyahu, particularly, and to his ability to control the situation. The biggest of being moving around port ships and the kind of naval capacity that would allow them to turn on a temporary, you know, a military port on the coast. And the reason for that is because that would be a port, that would be an entry into Gaza that they do not control at all. What are they, you know, and so what, if the Biden administration decided to do that, plug that thing in and stand it up anyway, what are their options? Their options are to try to blockade it. That's pretty hilarious. Or to attack it, et cetera. Like, they can't do anything about it. And so to me, I think that's what's staying the hand, is there's been enough serious material moves by the Biden administration that I do think the rest of the government is viewing it much more seriously. Again, I still think a lot of it's performative. I agree with that. And I still, you know, totally disagree with their prosecution of the entire thing and their stance on it in general. I don't think he's any less genocidal than he has been, but I do think that they're irritated. To your point, I think they're done with, more than done with Netanyahu, and they're those kind of moves to me show them, like, hey, you can say whatever you want to Knesset. At a certain point, we're bigger than you, and we're going to do it anyway. That's how it reads to me.
Yeah. Also, turning against the U.S. is not like the smart political play for the government, because if the U.S. turns on them back, all of Europe, literally all of their substantive allies in North America and the transatlantic Western powers will turn on them too.
Yeah, the only people that haven't voted against them openly will flip, right? Yeah. Because that's all U.S. core things, you know. And as you pointed out last week or in previous material, Netanyahu's opposition went to Washington by himself, you know, independently. That's already happened. So Netanyahu's competition is already talking to the administration.
Yeah, his main political rival went to Washington to speak privately with the Biden administration.
Historically, the only thing more dangerous than going against an American administration is going against an American administration with a really valid alternative to yourself, you know, in your country. That's historically by the CIA.
So is this Netanyahu being a sacrificial lamb? Is that what this is all about?
Oh,
like he knows that he's the fall guy.
There's plenty of people in that government that would want him to take that role. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's what it is. He knows he's a sacrificial lamb, and he's the one to be the bad guy and get the dirty work done while everybody else can save face and distance themselves from him and his decisions.
Yeah.
But it's the same machine.
I think they're going to force him to do that. I think he's way too much of a sociopath to ever do that voluntarily. I think he'd watch the whole thing.
Bro. It would take a sociopath to go along with something like that. It could go either way. It's like you're a sociopath for staying the course, or you're a sociopath for doing the dirty work and being the bad guy officially. Either way.
It makes sense. Yeah.
I think, though, like that his main far-right power base, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, aren't going to fall on their swords with Bibi in solidarity with him. No, I mean...
Politician's going to politician. That'd be crazy to expect that.
No, but you did bring up the aid port into Gaza, and Mondo Vice, if the audience isn't tracking what this publication is, it's independent news and opinion about Palestine, Israel, and the United States. I made a video on Instagram. I don't know if y'all follow me there, but it's where I post my short-term content about one of the reasons why they keep re-rating again and again. This is the fourth time they've rated Al-Shifa Hospital. But Mondo Weiss has an interesting opinion piece that Israel's latest attack on Al-Shifa Hospital, which happened Sunday night, and is still ongoing, by the way. They're still conducting combat operations inside the hospital and in the immediate vicinity. Israel's latest attack on Al-Shifa and the successful delivery of food and aid to northern Gaza are connected. So they basically assert that the operation itself was a hit. The director of operations of the Gaza police force, a part of Gaza's government's civilian administration, was the target. He did not operate clandestinely at the start of the war. He didn't have to, because he was in charge of civil law enforcement, especially in northern Gaza. And Hamas released a statement after his death confirming that he engaged in purely civil and humanitarian activity. And based off the journalists that we're talking to on the ground, they confirmed that he was part of the civilian administration. He was responsible for logistics, aid distribution, and civilian law enforcement, because things are degrading at exponential pace here. So Israel, the IDF, put out a statement saying they had launched a precise operation on al-Shifa to target a, quote, top Hamas operative or a senior Hamas commander who the army alleged was planning attacks on Israel. But of course, everybody on the ground does believe the attack on al-Shifa was an assassination operation aimed at breaking down civil order in northern Gaza to facilitate, you know, Israel's ongoing genocidal project. Also, if there isn't any sort of civilian order or mechanism to distribute U.S. aid coming from the port, well, that's good, because if aid can't be orderly and evenly distributed, that furthers Israel's plan. And that kind of undermines, in a way, the America's humanitarian intervention in the Strip.
Can we go through the timeline of al-Shifa Hospital, the first breaching of the hospital by the IDF?
That was in November, I think. It all blends into one freaking shit show, honestly.
I know. So that's why it confused me when I saw the headline about, like, wait, they're raiding it again? Like, what's this about? So they're saying, so basically the going theory is that that became the hub for organization of humanitarian aid, and they just went in there to disrupt it again.
According to Al Jazeera, 30,000 people were sheltering in al-Shifa Hospital in the north as of this past weekend. So what happens when they hit it, they sent in one of their a special operations group, and then they cordoned it off with, I don't know, some mech infantry guys. And everybody, thousands and thousands of people fled. And so in my video that I made about this earlier, I basically alleged that there were multi-form purposes for this. First of all, it reinforces to the Israeli public more of their propaganda. They're hitting al-Shifa Hospital because Hamas went back in there, and they continue to use human shields. So we're going to keep going into places where they have human shields.
They went in and killed the top civilian police officer in Gaza in the hospital with a spec ops team.
There's some confused reporting going on the ground, but yes, he is confirmed killed. Yes.
But they're not sure if it's from the same action or not.
We've heard that it is from the same action.
It's a lot harder to pretend that he was collateral. If it was a soft team, a special operations force team, than a bombing, meaning if that guy's dead, that they went in there to intending to make him dead, you know, is how I would read that, right?
That's how everybody's reading it.
Yeah, it's like
in Gaza. Yeah,
we were trying to bomb Hamas, and we accidentally killed the lead civilian official in charge of distributing aid and maintaining order. You know, oops, no, you went in there with like commandos and shot him. So that seems pretty cut and dry.
So has there been any talks about a replacement for him to help distribute the aid, somebody to take his spot? Is there any word on that, or is there maybe a chain of command that somebody else?
Here's another...
It's a police department, so you'd have to assume so.
Okay, well, here's a further paragraph from the same article. So also, Mondo Vice is very highly regarded in journalism circles. I'll just say that. More so than CNN and The Economist are at this
time. Hey, anything beyond what we have now, I'll take it.
All right, quote, Israel has not only welcomed the development, but actively encouraged the state of lawlessness. Its continued targeting of Gaza police escorts only reinforced the phenomenon. At around the same time, Israeli officials began to float the idea of post-war tribal rule in Gaza. This relates to the second part of the speculation surrounding Mahmoud's assassination, that he was involved in cracking down on clans that seized food aid, likely to be the same clans who would be contenders in Israel's vision of post-war rule in Gaza. So it says, regardless of the veracity of the speculation, what has become clear is that Israel's genocidal war has taken on a new dimension. It is encouraging societal collapse in Gaza. It's engineering a famine, which we all agree on, and the enablement of lawlessness by, again, targeting civilian police is simply a continuation of its military campaign through other means. And when members of the civilian government attempt to ameliorate the famine or try to work to restore social order, Israel launches a war against them, too. Mm-hmm. So that is the contention of this Mondo Vice article.
Well, they would love that narrative, too, wouldn't they, that, you know, Gaza's ruled by tribal warlords, you know what they would say. They would love that.
Savages. Mm-hmm. They need to restore order. We're here to civilize you. That's like right out of the colonizer handbook. That's been around.
That's what they teach 7-year-olds in their classrooms. So yeah, I mean,
they're trying to Mad Max all of Gaza right now, and just so they can. Yeah, and I guarantee you that's when they're gonna bust out the cameras and try to film the chaos going on and just say, hey, see, look what they're doing.
Yes, starving.
Yeah, my first assumption before you talked about that guy dying, my first assumption of why they went back into Al-Shifa was evidence destruction. Frankly, that's what I was like. I was like, oh, they probably went in to clean up some stuff.
I made a secondary point, which was like also 30,000 people were sheltering there. So what we've been saying since the beginning, like you and I, Travis, that conventional weapons alone cannot effectuate a genocide. First of all, there's the troop morale. We saw this with SS foreign brigades in like Poland during the Second World War, mass graving thousands of people. Well, they drank themselves to death. They started committing suicide. They started shooting their officers because it doesn't matter how indoctrinated you are. You're still ostensibly a human being with human psychology. And that's newsflash, not good for you. Also, there's just not enough bullets and not enough bombs. So wouldn't you just have to destroy infrastructure, which they've done. But if you look at all the other genocides in history, they're not unique. They all look the same. There's forced displacement, intentional famine, disease, maybe death camps, maybe forced labor camps. But yeah, when you forcibly displace people that are sheltering in a hospital, thousands of people, well, that's forced displacement. Now they're going to sleep out in the cold and the rubble, getting rained on, not having centralized, secure locations for, like, to collect food or aid.
And also, you can see in a lot of them, like, routine, repeated forced displacement, right? Like, so forced displaced from one zone and then pushed out, and then pushed again and then pushed again and then pushed again. That's U.S. history. It's a pretty good example of that one. You know, and every time you displace people and move people, it gets a little bit worse and a little bit worse and a little bit worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you aren't familiar with U.S. history and you're listening, Gigi can just Google the Trail of Tears. And same principle.
And what the Turkish did to the Armenians.
Oh, yeah. All genocides have a through line. Please. Oh, sorry, Mark. Good to continue, please.
I just wanted to go through the numbers, the stats real quick about Rafah. So what I'm reading is you got 22,200 per square kilometer in Rafah right now. And prior to the invasion of Gaza, you had 275,000. Now you have 1.4 current, Now, the other thing that Hiba brought up, she told me that from her contacts on the ground, the connection, the internet connection is terrible in Rafah right now due to the, I guess they're running their internet off of solar panels. So because of the constant, IOF or harassment and damage being done to the infrastructure, it's hindering that internet connection. So it definitely feels like it's priming for a huge massacre. And that's how apparently a lot of the people in Rafah really feel on the ground. They have a feeling that the world's about to end right now. That's how they're thinking that the internet goes out. There's going to be very few people with eyes on it. IOF rolls in, just mass casualties that we can't even imagine compared to, say, the Flower Massacre, way worse. So that's how everybody's feeling on the ground down there, according to Hiba. So,
well, yeah. Also, they hope to the people I was talking to are hoping to escape. Even if they have to like be displaced in Egypt, they're hoping to get into that buffer zone that's being created in between the Rafah crossing and the Sinai Peninsula.
Yeah. By the way, what's that border look like what's the main barrier? Is it like the typical fence you see along the Israel and Gaza border?
It's less elaborate and less hardcore, because if you look at the fence on the Egypt Gaza crossing, on the Gaza side, it's actually quite horrible. There's just like redundant rows of razor of like Constantina wire up until the top. It's not as medieval as that because there's not enough time to construct that. But it's also hard to get. It's also hard to get like satellite imagery. So I can't. And the guy we talked to, Matt, my buddy Matt, who's ex Army infantry officer, he tried to get to Rafa, but he was turned around by the police. So we couldn't get eyes on the ground there either. So I'm not sure exactly what the fence looks like.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. So it's kind of like a fish in the barrel right now, you know, herding them in.
Well, here's the thing, like all of this current blowback to Rafa is like everybody with half a brain knows it's going to be a catastrophe. And Biden knows that, like, he's like, what, polling at 38% right now, which is hugely low. That means he's going to lose to Trump, and there's going to be no coming back from Rafa, probably, if this goes south.
So, I mean, there's a very good chance that you know, Michigan's already irrecoverable for him, and that matters, right? And that's a state that matters in a national election. So, yeah.
Right.
He can't afford a single other incident, and they're continuing to happen.
Also, the DNC is not just concerned about the Biden election. They're concerned about other elections that will also be up, like congressional and senatorial elections that they don't want their candidates associated with.
AOC announced some on her Instagram page. She announced some, $20 million something deal or funding package for her area in New York. And like the top 30 comments were all about Gaza and ceasefire and genocide. Nothing to do with the political victory that she was trying to announce on her platform.
Yeah. So it's not because Biden actually gives two shits about non-white people on the other side of the planet. He doesn't. I had a security clearance in Afghanistan, and guess what? Us girls talked. He's always been a racist POS. So that's not changing anytime soon. This is strictly, he is a career politician. He's had his hands on, he helped introduce and sponsor the mass incarceration bill back in the day. You know, he's a white supremacist, you know? Doesn't matter that he had a good working relationship or even a friendship with Obama. That means absolutely nothing. So he doesn't care about the Palestinians at all. There's no reason to think that he's having a quote unquote come to Jesus moment.
Yeah. Well, that's power. That's about power projection, right? But to your point though, this is a very dangerous situation or very politically dangerous situation for every Democrat who's got a race this year. You know, not just him.
Yeah. Yeah. Good riddance too. I mean, he's always been, like Greg said, he's always been a racist piece of shit. I mean, what's funny is when his racism comes out as a result of his old age, his dementia, that's when it's hilarious because remember when he was saying that black people can't vote because they don't know how to use a laptop. What was that thing he said back?
He also just said like white people and poor people, like that's the two categories, right?
Right. Yeah. It's just hilarious to watch that racism come out as a result of it. It's like, dude, you just sunk the whole Democratic Party with your shit. And
wait,
it's so obvious.
Wait, just as a ancillary point, did he say that what the two classes of people were white people and poor people? Because there are branches of the Stoker family that live in Arkansas who are both. So
Jesus.
Yeah, you know, so we just had South by Southwest here in Austin. I'm pretty sure everybody in the pro-Palestine community may have seen something about it because even like TRT News Channel and Mint Press were putting out slides about how one of the biggest music festivals on the planet was being sponsored by the United States Army and Raytheon, a.k.a. RTX Corps, a.k.a. one of the main defense contractors that's producing some of the bombs that are actively being dropped on Gaza. And it was this big scandal. We did some protesting outside of Raytheon's booth. Some people got arrested for standing in the road. But anyways, yeah, that was over with. And that was kind of a big deal because I've never seen the Army sponsor you know, a civilian festival, not to
having
an artistic civilian festival.
That's not true.
No,
sorry.
It's not.
No, they do it all the freaking time. But
really? I've never seen such a high profile one though.
What you're talking about, what you were protesting, that's odd. Where they've got like a defense contractor like forum going on at a music festival. The Army sponsors freaking NASCAR, sports, music all over the place because it's for recruiting.
Yeah.
But having like defense contractors at a music festival is really fucking weird. That is really
weird. I mean, weren't those festivals used to be like a venue for anti-war films and anti-war art once upon a time?
Yeah, for sure. But that I'm just telling you, like, if you go look at various things and look at who the sponsors are, you'll see like the Navy, the Air Force.
Yeah, they
do that. It's a recruiting function. But having defense contractors have a like sub South by function, you know, is really fucking weird. Like, cause you've seen like some of the expansion and like, oh, there's a tech part of South by Southwest. There's a business part of it. But this is the first time I've ever seen a defense contractor part of South by Southwest. Like what's next? Are we going to have like a, you know, like an arms expo? Is it like an arms expo?
We're going to have Lockheed Martin, sponsoring Rage Against the Machine.
Well, you're going to have like the sound stage over here. And then over here, you're going to have like a bunch of howitzers, you know, a couple MiGs. You know, have like a little arms expo going on. You know?
I mean, it is Texas, so who knows? Like Greg Abbott probably has a hard on for that. He's our governor. He's completely compromised by.
But yeah, to your point, this is kind of a terrible town to do that in and associate it with music because that's not going to be a popular association.
Yeah, no, we were talking about this on Saturday night. About this human shields argument that they've never put it away, but you know they've tried to do many iterations of it. And Travis and I were at the tail end of South by Southwest. I was a little toasty. You know, we started talking about like what would be an effective demonstration for some people to kind of conceptualize how like the human shields argument worked, how it doesn't work for like it doesn't work for U.S. troops. Like we can say that, but there are anecdotes that we could give that actually demonstrate that. So
If good or bad on the comparison, which I think NATO will always come out looking rosy compared to the IDF, any NATO force will. But you know, to Greg's point, like we were talking about, like how we're trained in shoot houses and stuff like that, and how our trainers react to it when we shoot the wrong thing, right? So you got the IDF going and smoking their own hostages who are yelling out in Hebrew, self-identifying, self-locating, telling the, you know, the stack where they are and still getting smoked. And Greg was talking about, you know, getting his ass chewed in a shoot house. I've seen the same thing. We were talking about what happens, like, you know, if you're, again, bad things happened. There are U.S. war crimes. Like no one's saying that doesn't happen, but
yeah,
you also will get a 15-6 investigation, a very serious one, for accidentally firing, you know, a rifle into the dirt in sector. I saw a kid get a 15.
Layers and layers of protocol. Yeah,
he accidentally discharged a 240 into a wall. It hit nobody. And that dude wasn't on patrol for three or four weeks while they investigated it, sent him to retraining, all that good stuff. And I won't tell the story for him.
I just turned 20. I had passed Ranger selection, which is unpleasant. It has a very high attrition rate. So once you pass, you think you're like badass, but I mean, you're not because you're 20.
Wait, it's higher than the National Guard.
Yeah. It's higher than your fucking JROTC bullshit, dude. I'm kidding. I'm sorry.
I mean, I got too many guards buddies to let this fly. They go to that school and also,
yeah,
don't forget the National Guard very frequently wins the sniper competition that the U.S. Army holds. So
yeah, that is true.
Don't shit on them too hard.
Yeah, but there's a lot of Texas boys in the National Guard. Just saying, and Southern boys. But anyways, I just passed Ranger selection. It was 8 weeks, unpleasant, and I was like, yeah, I'm in special operations. I'm fucking cool. I'm tough, but you know, and smart. And it's like, no, you're not, because you're 20 years old, you're still a freaking dumbass. But anyways, what you do is, you know, you need to start actually training with your special operations unit. And one of the many things you have to do is go into what's called a shoot house. A shoot house is a mock training compound that you have to clear You have to assault and you have to clear it. And there are targets that have guns that are the enemy combatants. And sometimes it's a fancy shoot house that they pop up, or they like turn a corner and they're on a track. And there's sometimes that they're just like dummy paper targets hanging on a wall with a wooden cutout of an AK-47 or a different type of rifle. And there are some targets that don't. Some are dressed in civilian clothes. Some are just paper targets without a gun. And so you do daytime iterations for clearing during the day. And there are different ways you clear depending on if it's day or night. But yeah, it was a nighttime shoot house, and like training under night vision and getting comfortable with how night vision works. And, you know, you have a laser, an infrared laser that can only be picked up on night vision that you have to like laze the target with. And that's where the bullet goes. Yeah. So I was trying to like be impressive and like, you know, quickly positively identify a target and engage it. So people would be like, oh, okay, Stoker's not that bad, because being a new guy in a special operations unit, especially Ranger Regiment, is absolutely fucking horrible. It was hands down the three worst month, like six worst months of my life. Like nobody stops fucking with you. I don't even want to talk about it, but I was like trying to prove myself, right? So I would get fucked with less. Anyways, I made the mistake of, you know, just being super nervous because, again, young kid, and I shot the wrong target. It was a civilian. And then instantly, it was at night. So the lights turn on, and there's a mezzanine on top of the shoot house where, you know,
the catwalks that go above.
Catwalks, yeah, for the instructor to rate you.
Yeah, for the instructors that are watching when everything's going. And then I heard it, like, fucking index, lights, who is that motherfucker? And I was just like, oh God, fuck. And I got jacked up against the wall and got threatened to be kicked out of Ranger Regiment and get sent to a regular line infantry unit to do patrols and get like blown up by an IED somewhere. And it was almost a thing. There's something that you can called RFS. It's released for standards that they have in certain units within the military, that if you're just like, can't get enough, you're not good enough, you can't hack it, you're sent to a subordinate or like less prestigious unit or whatever. And so yeah, that was my experience with like shooting a civilian target, not even an actual civilian, which we do investigate. And, you know, some people actually go to jail for that, but that was just like a target in training. So that is my personal like civilian military targets thing. And of course I did witness firsthand overseas mistakes being made. I'd say for the most part, like some of them weren't malicious, some of them were, but the thing is it wasn't institutionalized and there were consequences.
Systemic.
You'd never get, even when you had, and I won't say I personally witnessed any malicious ones, but our kinetics were a lot different than a unit like that too. But what you never saw was institutional top coverage, or not on any large scale.
It'd be a fucking scandal. It would be all over the fucking the news. Like at the very least, the United States military has low level, you know, repercussions, and we have these very public standards that we lay. So at the very least, it would be a scandal if it happened.
I remember, if you remember that lieutenant that shot a prisoner in Afghanistan, I believe it was in Afghanistan, like near a bridge or under a bridge, and he ended up going to Leavenworth for it. He ended up going to prison for it.
It was no. Didn't, wasn't he an officer that ordered?
He was an officer. No, he did it.
He did it himself. I thought he ordered it.
No, that's so crazy. He did it himself. His entire unit testified, yeah, this guy was a scumbag and he shouldn't have done that, and he should go to jail. And then Trump pardoned him.
Oh, okay. What a surprise. Oh, now I remember that. Yeah.
But if you look at what his peer soldiers were saying before and after, and even after the pardoning and stuff happened, they were all, he was not being covered for. The institution did not cover for him.
Yeah.
No, I remember within the SOF community, sorry, that's Special Operations Forces, that's the acronym. There was a freaking psycho of a Australian SAS guy that was straight up EJKing people. Again, sorry for the acronyms. EJK is an extrajudicial killing, and it's like the easiest war crime to prove. It's what that lieutenant that Travis just mentioned did. Because if someone's already a prisoner and they're executed without trial, that's extrajudicial.
Well, that IDF IOF raid into the hospital where they killed those three guys in hospital beds, those are EJKs too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very obvious one.
Yeah, because they're non-combatants. So, yeah, the SAS guy went to jail, still in jail, and that was like a decade ago. And he's not getting out. So we do institutionally punish that. There's nothing, and I'm not like trying to be an apologist for, you know, United States and coalition forces war crimes, but
yeah, luckily you don't have to be an apologist to make a very positive comparison between NATO forces and the IDF.
Yeah,
because the disparity, like one can be bad and the other is 1,000 times worse. And
those exactly. It's not we're not giving immunity to, you know, our army or saying that we're bragging about it. It's just the obvious standards that we have compared to theirs. And amongst the other, you know, things that are fucking evil about what's happening in Gaza, on top of that, you have the precedents that are now being set for other militaries where maybe it turns into a disease where it turns into a contagious mentality that other militaries be like, well, they're doing it. Maybe we'll see if we can get away with it more. Like
it's also a situation in India. It's a supporting argument that's being used. That's bullshit. So I agree. Like what you're saying, I agree with. That's a danger. Is that standard slips across the board, and other countries go, well, they got away with it. But the other one is, I think a little bit more of what Greg was talking about. You'll hear them. Human shields is how this whole conversation started, right? That topic keeps coming up.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you'll see American politicians, American journalists, Western journalists, Western politicians, etc., parrot that line. That these, it's normal. Hey, these are casualties of military operations. And that line is horseshit because to what we were just talking about, NATO does not train its forces this way, and they do not conduct themselves this way on any kind of institutional standard. So to use this justification like, it's warfare. People get killed in warfare. Well,
I hate that.
You don't roll through smoking civilians.
We were saying that in one of the podcasts. We're like, this, the people who talk like that, this is war. It's like, that's why people
I've almost never seen anyone who knows what the fuck they're talking about say something like that. I've seen
exactly. They're people who haven't seen war.
I've seen a lot of guys who got close to war
say they got close. Exactly.
Okay, cool, you deployed, dude. Where were you? Okay, cool. When you find out where they were, they were almost never.
They may have been at an FOB. And they may have been an FOB, and they maybe saw an SOF unit coming back in from a patrol and being like, they were close to it. Maybe they shot a few rounds in a certain direction at one point in a firefight, but they haven't seen
it. One of the reasons for that, I think, is because if you were in a very kinetic unit or, in kinetic situations, you're not going to say that because you're like, whoa, hold on. The fuck I didn't, you know, I didn't do that. You know, my guys didn't do that, right?
Right, exactly. They don't want to be attached to it because they know the repercussions.
If you're some fobbit, you'd be like, oh, yeah, we smoke dudes all the time. That's worth it. No, you didn't, dude. No, you didn't.
Yeah, dude, I was a badass motherfucker back in the day. It's like, all right, something that's ancillary to that, something that's correlated to that is part of their human shields argument, which is Hamas doesn't wear uniforms. And going back to my shoot house thing, the criteria for what demarcates a civilian and a combatant is there a gun? I got jacked up against the wall because there wasn't a gun. And that's always the thing. It's like, okay, you know, we were actually fighting the, you know, people in Afghanistan, insurgents in Afghanistan, like the Taliban, the Haqqani, proto-Islamic State or ISIC, which is the Islamic State in the Khorasan. They didn't wear uniforms.
No.
That's just never been a freaking thing.
I've never fought anybody wearing a uniform. Ever. Ever.
Yeah,
in 10 years in the army, multiple deployments, I never fought anyone with a uniform. I love especially if they're Americans. I'd love to turn that question back around and go, okay, so the Minutemen didn't wear uniforms. Would the British have been justified going through Boston smoking everybody in their households? Like,
wow, that's easy. That's an easy turnaround.
It's just point, you know, here's your own version of it from your own history.
Yeah,
would that have been okay?
What do uniforms have to do with anything, really. It's like, do they have a gun? Do they not? And again, Taliban, Haqqani, Islamic State, they actually do employ suicide bombers. But
Mark always makes this point to us, which is we're evaluating this like they follow any kind of fucking ROE, and they don't.
Oh, so. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's just, yeah, it's funny to watch. It's like you guys are circling the shadow. You guys are about to get it. Yeah, it's because you're fucking insane fucking murderers.
Yeah, ROE rules of engagement. They are not following any kind of rules of engagement at all. It's so obvious when you watch their operations. Do you remember the ladies who are not trained tankers who just jumped in a tank and started cranking off tank shells on October 7th? And that story was like, they're heroes. And I was like, do you know what would happen to you in the U.S. Army if you jumped in an Abrams tank and were not a tank crew and started firing
Leavenworth, baby, Leavenworth
into populated areas? Or if at all, you could shoot them into the desert, you'd still be done. You'd still go to prison.
Yeah,
you'd be Leavenworth.
That is fucking insane. But again, no rules of engagement. So
yes, speaking of that, because this is just for some people to use as like talking points, because In special operations, we nominally had rules of engagement, but like, I still didn't experience like that. Like, none of that shit happened. But you know, if it did, we could have gotten away with it. And I'm not saying that special operations units didn't do some dirty boy stuff, because
there's a certain amount of collateral sign off based on the value of the target, which is we've shown before in other forums on, you know, your Instagram or whatever, where, you know, artillery sign off on targets, the same thing happens. Like, if it's going to do a certain amount of damage, it just the rank of the person that has to put their ass on it has to write their name on that operation and say, yes, I approve this, just goes higher and higher. So yeah. I mean, there's no one out there going, I sign off on EJKs, but you know,
right. But I wanted to preface the whole special operations thing, but you led a mechanized infantry platoon, which is basically what the IDF is. They're mostly mech infantry, but you did it in Baghdad. So as an American, what were your rules of engagement generally?
Ours were the relatively strict ones that I think to a certain extent, a good chunk of the American public is aware of, which is we can't fire without positive identification. Someone has to be an armed threat for us to engage them. And I'll tell you a second one. A lot of the time, we would roll out the gates without, not on the rifles, but especially on the crew serves, the weapons that's, you know, the 50 cal that's going to go through five houses if it goes off, frequently would not have those red. There wouldn't be a bullet in the chamber on them. They'd have them in an amber status if the weapon could do that. Some can't. Or just, you know, the soldier would have to rack it before engaging something. But
yeah,
I mean, the ROE was, the rules of engagement were really strict. I mean, we were dealing with car bombs and stuff too at checkpoints and shit. That's why I've never been able to excuse any of the IDF videos that I've seen from the beginning. Cause it was like, dude, we did checkpoint operations. First of all, I wasn't throwing 9-year-old girls' bikes in the bushes. But you know, on top of that, like we took you would see for the most part, NATO units taking every precaution to not kill civilians before they started pulling the trigger. Now, when you start getting shot, yes, obviously we're returning fire at people that are shooting or you know, insurgents that were engaging us. But yeah, the ROE was pretty strict. I think it was similar to most of the line units in Afghanistan were operating under very similar ROE to the ones in Baghdad.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Afghanistan units, infantry units that, you know, in the era of COIN, which is a counterinsurgency doctrine that coalition forces eventually adopted, was you don't fire actually until fired upon. Like that was the strictest.
It can be, well, you know, and you do have a lot of local national armed units. You've got national police, you've got Iraqi army. There's a lot of, you know, what the army would call, or what the military would call green, you know, there's green team units in sector as well. So I don't know what the state of the uniforms of the Afghan army, but the Iraqi army could, you'd have militia occasionally that were affiliated too. So you can't just walk around shooting every dude you see with an AK. That would go pretty badly, pretty fast. And then, you know, on top of that, I don't think you want to do the basics of counterinsurgency doctrine in this video, but
no.
Rules of engagement are a pretty important part of that. And one of the reasons for that is every time you kill some person,
even killed if, somebody's dad,
even,
mom.
Even if you kill a person that's shooting at you, you may create three more insurgents because you killed
someone. Yeah, exactly. And then, and at that point, you're they're definitely justified to shoot back at you. You know, they're
killing bystanders who aren't involved.
Yeah.
You're definitely just turned a bunch of
you're the enemy. At that point, you are the enemy.
100%. So this whole thing with Israel defeating Hamas by carpet bombing Gaza, it's like, bro, you just... I'm not the one that said it. I'm just parroting it. You know, you've guaranteed that Hamas will always exist, you know, by doing that.
Palestinian friend of mine, he said that there's, you know, talk going around about one of the Hamas fighters firing an RPG at a tank. But before he did that, he says, this is for my daughter. And how the Palestinians read that was like, this was a non-militant Hamas member or not a Hamas member at all, who had recently lost his daughter, and now he just joined up with Hamas to fight. So think of how much of that's going around. So yeah, so either way, their whole strategy is just all shit.
People don't want to do that. You know, that's a narrative that they like to perpetuate. U.S. media is pretty good at perpetuating it too. That these people are savages and they like being insurgents. That's not true. These people want to raise their families. They want to have jobs. They want to go to school. Yeah. It was the same in Iraq. It's mostly the same in Afghanistan. Judging by what I've been told by other vets, I wasn't there. But definitely the same in Iraq. Some of the most effective counterinsurgency techniques were making sure that the neighborhood was employed, you know, because people don't want to do that crap. They don't want to get shot over some political BS. They don't.
Yeah. And also, what's the unemployment? What has been the historical unemployment rate in Gaza? Like nearing 50%. Also, just on a basic line, if you actually saw these people as humans, you'd realize that, you know, humans want to do human stuff. They want to like have social lives and, you know, have like hobbies and goals and families. And guess what? Being an insurgent fucking sucks. You're sleeping in a hole, not eating enough food, probably going to die painfully. Cause like, it's not Hollywood. Once you're shot, you're fucking sitting with that wound until you bleed out. And it might take you longer than you'd like to go into shock. And even when you go into shock, you're fucking thirsty.
Yeah. So, You're not a NATO soldier with a 1 hour, you know, the 1 hour golden hour exfil likelihood, right? That's a great point. You're not going to get treatments not available. I mean, it's a horrible life.
Yeah, it's a horrible life. No, nobody wants it, but because they've created this narrative, not just recently, not just since the creation of the State of Israel, but over hundreds of years, that people from certain places that look certain ways, that believe in certain things, like Islam, are just do that shit because we don't know why, you know, they just do it. They're just not humans. This has been building for a long time, and I've never seen a grosser, more plain manifestation of this. And when we circle back to the Rafah assault, the reason people are accepting it, 1.5 million people, how many, based off of what they're saying, how many Hamas fighters are left based off their bullshit numbers that they just pull out of their ass. They've got like what, 10,000 guys left. So like what, which obviously they have more. Duh. I'm not saying that, but according to our own intelligence sources, they've got way more. But anyways, I just wanted to clarify that. But assuming for the sake of argument, there's like 10,000, 5,000 left hiding in Rafah. Again, absurd, but you're going to subject 1.5 million people because of that. And one of the reasons we're able to accept this is because one of this insidious, like post 9/11 talking point ideas, which I witnessed firsthand amongst coalition forces and U.S. forces in Afghanistan, was, well, it sucks, but it takes a village. It takes a village to make a terrorist. Therefore, everybody's complicit. Am I wrong?
Is that wrong?
It's wrong morally.
It takes a village to create somebody like Biden.
Yeah, you can totally say that, right? That ideology exists, and that's why people in the West are able to accept it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they think that that's like a cultural, I don't know, it's like a cultural ideal or desire of individuals in that society to participate in that stuff by default. And it's like, that's wild, you know?
You know what gets me though with that mentality, what you guys are talking, takes a village. One of the things that just gets under my skin is when I talk to somebody who's normally on a normal day is reasonable. And I'm like, dude, they're massacring civilians in Gaza, just trying to talk some sense into them. And their response is, like, well, if they want all this to stop, they just have to give up Hamas. I'm like, even if like they're starving to death, they have no ability to give up Hamas. Like, there's no like even in that argument alone, like saying that the Gazans can somehow give up and say, all right, we surrender, here's Hamas. It doesn't work that way.
No, it's like you get shot whether you have a weapon or not. You get arrested whether there's a conflict or not. How many people did they arrest in the West Bank this year when there's nothing going on there? The show's on the other side. Like,
it's such a numbskull excuse, though, that you hear from people who are not aware of what's happening. They'll just say, well, all they got to do is just give up Hamas and all this will stop. It's like, shut the fuck up. You know, these civilians have no power to do shit. They're starving to death. They're barely walking. Like, they're no water. Like, what do you want them to do? Like, what? There's nothing they can do. It's just, yeah.
Well, I mean, this, I'm going to bring it up just for the latecomers to our platform. We bring up the Daya doctrine all the time. And again, just to recap, in case you haven't heard about it, the Daya is a suburb in West Beirut that during the 2006 Lebanon War, where the IDF invaded southern Lebanon and engaged Hezbollah in an open confrontation, and Hezbollah wiped the floor with them, rolled them back, they hammered this suburb of Beirut, killed a lot of people. It was collective punishment because it was meant to, as they were withdrawing, that the civilians would be hurt so bad that they'd give up Hezbollah or never allow Hezbollah to fight Israel again. Did it work? Obviously not. Hezbollah's launching shit ton of rockets every day, displacing tens and tens of thousands of settlers in the north. And then it's not working with Hamas because it doesn't work, because that's not how resistance works. The civilian suffering is never a primary consideration for a resistance movement against an occupying force. When the French resistance assassinated Nazi officers, and then the Nazi troops, German troops, would round up random civilians in the suburbs of Paris, line up against the wall and shoot them as a reprisal against the resistance, who was prosecuted at Nuremberg? Was it the resistance or was it the Nazis? So the basics of their military doctrine is collective punishment. So it actually works with dumbasses. It works with dumbasses, as you brought up, Mark and Travis. It's like, yeah, just give up Hamas and it would be over. Doesn't work. It's never worked. So stop arguing that.
No, absolutely. And again, even our, like, whatever, if you're from Western countries, if you're from a NATO country, your counterinsurgency doctrine says explicitly not to do shit like that, because
the opposite. You want to win the hearts and minds of the civilians, save them, feed them, give them safety, give them an incentive to be like, hey, life is great over here in this safe area. Don't, you know? So Israel is saying, okay, here's a safe area, and then they fucking bomb it.
So even if you're dumb enough to believe, it's a justifiable statement or justifiable method, ask yourself why. You know, none of the major military powers in the Western NATO use that doctrine.
And the Israelis don't even believe it. The IDF obviously knows that this doesn't work, but it's a great line to give your American simps and fanboys back in the States, saying, well, look what they're doing. I mean, they're trying to create a safe corridor for these civilians, but they're just loyal to Hamas. And it's just a simple headline to give them. You know, Can we go back to the Rafa thing real quick? So I want to go back to Israel's official claim and excuse of going into it.
Our counterinsurgency doctrine is like, yeah, win hearts and minds and stuff. It didn't really, I mean, it worked somewhat, but it's never going to get rid of resistance when you're in occupation.
Yeah,
power.
No, it's,
you know? I mean, that's accurate. I will say that the effectiveness and what came of it from your and I's two theaters is a vastly different experience, you know, in very different situations. So,
I mean, it would, that doctrine would work on Americans. If China invaded and they offered a Starbucks and Walmart, I mean, I'm sure Americans would be turning against each other in a second. So, I mean, it only works on, let's say, like a Western population. It's not going to work on a population that's been subjected to imperialist oppression for God knows how long.
And again, none of us are apologists for this kind of shit. So when I say worked or functioned better, I don't mean they accepted the occupational boot or the imperialist boot. our forces just got shot less, right? There was less people willing people willing to be violent against us because
they weren't shot by 70-year-old men who were
in Basra, places, Karada, places in Baghdad that just weren't dangerous because NATO, you know, coalition forces weren't walking around smoking people and blowing buildings up all the time. So
no, imagine the American casualties that would be mounting up if we did just do what Israel does. Yeah. Like the whole population would just be out there trying to shoot us.
Yeah. So it'd be a number I'm not saying it works, but like there's a reason that none of them prosecute.
It works enough to keep our boys safe to an extent. Yeah. Like
I mean, look, okay, so yeah, but there as Travis said, there are complications to counterinsurgency doctrine in Afghanistan, especially when it was a proxy war that where the ISI, which is the Pakistani intelligence in Iran, were involved. But this is way beyond the scope of even this channel.
You're also talking about a level of theory where it's like, do you even believe that it's possible to effectively do this? And that and that's argued about by four stars.
Yeah.
So
you know. Anyways, yeah. So all this Rafa thing is going to do. They're going to be more aggressive than pretty much any, you know, NATO military. And the reason we keep bringing this up is because Israel wants to be associated with a Western military, even though, you know, don't really see that happening. They don't follow our rules of engagement. Also, they kind of suck. And yeah, so it's all this is going to do is breed more resistance, get Joe Biden unelected, and turn Israel into a pariah state. Do we have we're at an hour. Do we have any closing stuff, guys?
Yeah, well, I just want to bring something to everybody's attention who may have not have heard. Right now, obviously, you know, everybody should know it's Ramadan and Gazans are starving. Israel was caught dropping leaflets, pretty sadistic leaflets on the Gazans, wishing them a happy Ramadan and telling them to give food to the poor. This is how sick they are. They're literally playing jokes and pranks and taunting the starving Palestinian children with little leaflets that wish them a happy Ramadan. So, you know, just want to bring that to everybody's attention. That's happening. The other thing is the excuse that Israel is using to raid Rafah is that there are four Hamas brigades supposedly there. And I still am like trying to think like where? Like did they just see them? They're out in the open. They're in the cave. Like they're in the tunnels. Like what? Where? Like,
also,
what are you talking about?
Also, how many men is in a Hamas brigade? Like you don't define your terms at all.
Exactly. Yeah, because Hamas is organizing a nice little square brigades on the ground.
And actually, historically, the word brigade is translated by us from Arabic in those names of those units comes from. It just means that's that organizational flag. Has nothing to do with the unit size, you know. No. It'll be like the tenth Day Martyrs Brigade, and that'll be 40 guys, and there'll be another, you know, something something brigade, and that's like 8,000 men. It's not a, you know, a better translation will be like army. I don't know.
Yeah. So I think we might, if this Rafa assault happens, which it looks like it's going to happen, because the dog is off its leash and. Netanyahu, this seems to be tying his existential political survival to a Rafa assault. It's not going to work out for him. He's already turned daddy against him, which is United States imperialism. He's not serving the interests of the elite necessarily. So if the assault launches in a couple days, hopefully we can get back together and do a tactical analysis of it. But this is where things stand right now.
God bless the people of Rafa and Rafa right now.
Hopefully it doesn't happen.
For the best.
Yeah, and it still might not, but they've been building this thing up for a long time. All right, thanks y'all for listening. We'll be back in a couple days with an episode about something. We're lining up a couple guests, so we're not sure who's going to be published first. So hope to see you then, and have as good a night as you or day as you can amidst these times, and see you on the next one.